all familiar with inflammation, the irritation of tissues that make a sprained ankle or a sore throat tender. That visible reaction to illness or injury isn't pleasant, but it's part of our body's bag of tricks for healing us, and we usually start to feel better once the swelling goes down. But some inflammation stays hidden even from us. We don't see it or feel it because it's buried deep within. And if it lasts long enough, it can cause serious damage. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Doctors have known for centuries that inflammation can be a symptom of disease. But more recently, scientists have begun to recognize that it may cause disease as well, maybe implicated in cancers, organ failures, even mental illness. Dr. Shilpa Ravella is here to talk about how that happens and how we can protect ourselves. She's a transplant gastroenterologist with expertise in nutrition and an assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University Medical Center, also author of the new book, A Silent Fire, The Story of Inflammation, Diet, and Disease. Shilpa, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Why do our bodies sometimes generate inflammation in the first place? What does it do for us when everything is working the way it's meant to?
Well, inflammation is actually an ancestral force, and it evolved to help us. It evolved to fight things like pathogens and poisons and traumas. All of these were very frequent in ancestral times, and inflammation evolved to deal with those things, to heal our bodies and to defend us. And when, you know, for example, you stub your toe, you can see things like redness, heat, swelling, and pain, and you can see the inflammation working to actually heal the wound eventually.
How is chronic inflammation different from the kind of acute inflammation that comes and goes when we have a temporary illness or injury?
We want inflammation to do its job, to come to fight these pathogens and poisons and traumas, and then to go away after we don't need it anymore. But sometimes what happens is that inflammation can persist. And this is kind of the biological price of inflammation, meaning that there's a cost to having this robust inflammatory response that helps us. And we can see chronic inflammation in things like autoimmune disorders, some of which we are very familiar with, like rheumatoid arthritis or inflammatory bowel disease. And that's a kind of chronic inflammation. Sometimes the chronic inflammation is unseen, and this is the notion of hidden inflammation.
So it turns out the balance of inflammation is really important, right? We're going to spend a lot of time talking about the ways that too much inflammation could cause problems for our health. What could happen if there were too little?
Well, one of the problems with too little inflammation is that we aren't able to mount inflammatory responses in order to be able to defend ourselves against germs or heal wounds. So we do need some level of inflammation in the body. So the idea isn't to bring the level of inflammation in your body down to zero, but to have the appropriate immune response, the appropriate inflammatory response, so that we have enough to fight these things that trouble us, but also that we resolve the inflammation and that the inflammation goes away when it's needed. If we don't have any inflammation in the body, then that poses an entirely new set of problems because we aren't able to deal with some of the day-to-day things that we need to deal with, that our immune systems exist to do, like protect us against germs.
Ancient physicians observe the mechanisms of inflammation. What did they make of the purpose of it and what it meant for the body?
Well, the ancients were able to see inflammation with their naked eye. So they were able to see redness, heat, swelling, and pain. They weren't exactly sure why it was there. It was really, you know, in the 19th century, there was a German scientist, Rudolf Virchow, who was better able to describe kind of the cellular characteristics of inflammation. And so he described all of the visible things that we see, redness, heat, swelling, and pain, on a more microscopic level. And he was able to ascertain that these things happen because, you know, blood flow increases in our body and fluid and protein leak out, causing swelling. The heat, you know, comes from that increased blood flow. And he was really one of the first ones who was able to define some of these cellular characteristics of inflammation. But for a long time, inflammation was just about what we could see with the naked eye. You know, we can see what happens if we stub our toe, but we weren't exactly sure what was going on inside there. And this whole idea that the body was actually doing something to defend itself, that that cells were actually rushing to areas of trauma and rushing to places where they found germs. This whole idea that the body could even do that was a very radical idea at one time.
Virchow was a real hero for this Russian zoologist who came along a few years later. How did he help drive that learning forward?
Ali Metchnikoff, he was a Russian zoologist, and he was one of the scientists who really came up with the first modern theory of immunity. He was on vacation in Italy with his family, and instead of doing fun things like going to the circus, he decided to stay in his laboratory and experiment. And some of the experiments he performed were in organisms like starfish. He was a zoologist, so he was very interested in all different types of organisms, aside from humans as well. And he would prick the starfish with all kinds of things, with a rose thorn. He'd inject bits of dye into them. And he saw these strange wandering cells kind of going to the areas where he had injected the dyes and kind of bothered the starfish in a certain way. And he wasn't sure what the wandering cells were doing. They seemed to be digesting the bits of dye and other materials. But what he thought to himself was, what if they weren't just digesting these things? What if this was sort of a primitive form of immunity? What if they were actually defending the body? And that idea for its time was just so breathtaking in its implications. This idea that the body could actually do things to defend itself from outside intruders.
Metchnikoff also suspected that inflammation could both produce benefits and cause damage at the same time.
He did, exactly. So when he was describing his the immune cells that he had discovered, macrophages, which are one of type of immune cells that you find in both acute and chronic inflammation, he acknowledged that there is a price to inflammation. And he was very wise in thinking this way, because we are imperfect beings. We are products of evolution, and it's the slow ascent towards imperfect perfection. And so there tends to be a biological price with some of these forces. And as with inflammation, and Metchnikoff realized that, and he understood that macrophages, for example, did great things for the body. They helped to defend the body, macrophages and other immune cells. And at the same time, you know, they also were prone to harming the body. Chronic inflammation, you find macrophages and lymphocytes, and chronic inflammation is not good for the body in certain contexts.
What are the most important distinctions, Shilpa, between the innate immune system and the adaptive immune system?
Well, the best way to think of it is that the innate immune system is kind of your first line of defense, and you can, you know, the innate immune system involves your skin, all of your orifices, for example, your gastrointestinal tract, your lungs, even the eyes and the hair on your body. The innate immune system is really our first line of defense. It's primitive, it's rash, it's not as discerning, and it's what the germs first face when they come into our bodies. And this was the arm of the immune system that Ali Metchnikoff helped to define. And it involves cells like neutrophils and macrophages, but also a variety of other cells. And the innate immune system calls on help from the more sophisticated adaptive immune system. And this arm of the immune system involves cells like B cells. Certain B cells produce antibodies, and T cells. So it's a more specific response. And in some ways, the distinction between the innate and adaptive immune system is artificial. We draw our own lines. You know, they work together. But the innate immune system can really be thought of as that first stage of the immune response when we encounter germs or poisons or anything else.
Just a quick digression here, because I think this is fascinating. What aspects of the immune system make it possible for tattoos to last a lifetime on our skin?
I thought that was an interesting finding that, you know, certain immune cells, like macrophages, for example, allow tattoos to last forever, because what happens is that tattoos, macrophages actually digest the ink, they gobble up the ink, and then when they die, they regurgitate that ink, and that ink is taken up by new macrophages, and that allows the tattoo to persist on the skin untouched.
So essentially, it allows the new macrophages to think, well, this is a safe substance here.
Yes.
Why might we be more prone to chronic inflammation than our earliest ancestors who were trying to survive under very different conditions than we find today?
Well, we were initially trying to fight all of these ancient killers, these pathogens and poisons and the saber-toothed tigers. And we've evolved very robust immune responses in order to be able to deal with this. If we didn't have a robust immune response, we would perish in that era. So evolution has given us this gift of sorts. But the problem is that we've transformed our environments from the food we eat to how we move, how much exercise we get, how we live our lives in so many ways, our social relationships, how much stress we have in our lives, the air we breathe, the chemicals we use and modern goods. So we've really transformed our relationship to other people, germs, to the environment, and our immune systems are just exquisitely sensitive to the triggers in this new world.
So I want to talk about some of the ways chronic inflammation can cause damage. How might it be as significant a contributor to cardiovascular disease as whatever quantity of cholesterol might be building up within our arteries?
Well, we know that half of all heart attacks actually occur in folks who do not have high cholesterol levels. And we know today that inflammation, being silently inflamed, is actually an independent risk factor in heart disease. And it took scientists a long time to be able to say that inflammation is actually a cause of heart disease. But we do have large-scale clinical trials now showing that if you take patients who have silent inflammation, and this is low-level inflammation that you can't see, that you may not even know that you have, but if you take those patients and you treat that inflammation with an anti-inflammatory agent, and you control for all of the other risk factors for heart disease, like high cholesterol or smoking or diabetes, high blood pressure, and you just focus on treating that inflammation, we know today that that portends a lower risk of heart attacks, stroke, death from cardiovascular disease. So inflammation is indeed an independent risk factor. It's not the only risk factor, and it doesn't replace cholesterol as a risk factor, but it is a risk factor in and of itself for heart disease.
What are C-reactive proteins?
C-reactive protein is a protein that's made by the liver in response to areas of inflammation. And C-reactive protein can be seen as a marker of inflammation in the blood. In fact, it acts like a thermometer of sorts to kind of take the temperature, how high is the inflammation in your blood. The problem is that C-reactive protein is not terribly specific. So that means that if you have an elevated C-reactive protein, we're not exactly sure sometimes why it's there, how long it's been there for, and what exactly it means. There is an entity called high sensitivity C-reactive protein, and this is what researchers study in heart disease. And high sensitivity C-reactive protein captures minute elevations of C-reactive protein, or CRP. And this is a test that can tell you if you have these low-level elevations that can portend heart attacks, strokes, cardiac death.
Are these kinds of tests like routinely administered to people who might have other risk factors during a physical, or is it something very special that doctors have to order?
One of the salient unifying threads of this idea of hidden inflammation is that we are not currently routinely used to testing for or treating it. So when you walk into a doctor's office, you may not be offered a test for hidden inflammation. Now, there are other proxies that can tell you if you are silently inflamed that your doctor may test for, such as high blood sugar.
Shilpa, if CRP tests, C-reactive protein tests, do find that inflammation in the body somewhere is thought to be higher than optimal, what options do physicians and their patients have to get those levels back under control?
Well, currently there are a variety of dietary and lifestyle factors that actually can trigger this type of chronic low-level inflammation. We are a ways away in heart disease from actually prescribing anti-inflammatory drugs to treat this low-level inflammation. We'll hopefully get there one day, and with other disorders as well, to be able to have large-scale clinical trials that can actually tell us that certain drugs can be very useful in the treatment of these disorders. But we do know that the root causes are dietary and lifestyle factors, and that there are things that we can do today to change our habits to help to control this type of low-level inflammation. And one of the most important things to start out with, I think, is just eating as many whole plant foods as you can. And I think we've all heard the age-old advice to eat more fiber. But one of the interesting things about fiber is that fiber can actually help to manipulate all arms of the immune system. It is one of our most anti-inflammatory nutrients. And 95% of Americans today don't even meet the recommended daily amounts of fiber that they are supposed to be getting. It's 25 grams in women and 38 grams in men. And 95% of us don't meet that. And to have these anti-inflammatory effects in our body, we need to go above and beyond those numbers, the 25 and the 38.
What does fiber do for us exactly?
Well, fiber is an amazing food because it can actually, certain types of fibers can be metabolized by the microbes in your gut. We have trillions of microbes in our gut called the gut microbiome, and they play a very important part in our health and in inflammation, including low-level hidden inflammation. And certain types of fibers are actually food for those gut microbes, and they help to keep those microbes in shape. So when the gut microbes digest certain types of fibers, they create all kinds of beneficial compounds. For example, short-chain fatty acids, which nourish the gut barrier and help to calm intestinal inflammation, but also inflammation throughout the body. So what fiber does is it creates a cohort of bacteria, a diverse cohort of bacteria in your gut. And it also alters the behaviors of these bacteria, the products that they are making, and what else they are actually doing. And this can have very, very anti-inflammatory effects in our bodies.
So I heard you say this, the best way to get this fiber is from whole plant foods. And I completely understand this. That said, there are products on the market, for people who don't think they're getting enough fiber in their diet and they take a spoonful of something and put it in a glass of water in the morning. Is that the same, in terms of benefits to the body as eating foods that provide that fiber naturally?
It's unfortunately not the same because studies have shown that high intake of fiber from whole plant foods is protective against a variety of chronic inflammatory disorders. And when I say chronic inflammatory disorders, I mean not only the chronic inflammatory disorders we are used to thinking of, like lupus and arthritis, but really our most pressing issues, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, obesity, neurodegenerative diseases. And we know that fiber has been shown to be protective against such a wide variety of disorders, but we also know that fiber supplements haven't shown the same benefits.
All right, let's talk about cancer here. Why might the chronic inflammation of the lungs caused, for example, by smoking, set people up for developing lung cancers?
Well, we know in general that inflammation and cancer have a very intricate relationship. So, inflammation can beget cancer. And cancer can also beget inflammation. So the immune system tries actually to get rid of tumors and tries to actually prevent your body from developing cancer. But we know that cancer can kind of co-opt the immune system as well. So when you have low-level inflammation, that is actually associated with a higher risk of a variety of cancers. And also when you have overt inflammation that you can see, and this is not in all cases, but in many cases. So for example, when you have chronic obvious inflammation, whether it's in the lungs or in the gastrointestinal tract, for example, that portends a higher risk of cancer because inflammation can take part in every stage of cancer development, really, from the initial genetic and epigenetic influences, to the actual growth and the spread of cancer throughout the body. And of course, you can have some places in the body, for example, the joints, where you have chronic inflammation with very little elevated cancer risk, and we're still working to find out why that is so. Could have something to do with the amount of resident germs in those areas, areas with fewer germs, even when they are chronically inflamed, may not have as high of a cancer risk. But cancer can also co-opt the immune system, meaning that tumors in the tumor microenvironment, you do see inflammation as a major component of that. And much of what you see, for example, in a chronic wound, also is happening when you have a tumor in the body. And tumors sort of co-opt the immune system in order to grow and spread around the body.
Some of this chronic internal inflammation, I mean, we might sort of feel pain or have symptoms from certain things, but there it sounds like there are also lots of kinds of inflammation that we can be carrying within us for years related to lifestyle without realizing it. We might think we're okay and in fact have processes of disease taking place.
Absolutely. And I think chronic inflammation is such a heterogeneous force. It exists in so many different forms. There's the overt version that you're able to see. There's the version that we are able, that we are used to typically diagnosing. And then there's this hidden iteration that we are not used to typically testing for in doctors' offices. And you certainly can have chronic low-level inflammation and not know it. And just something as simple as that belly fat being a marker of silent inflammation. And with the advent of obesity being such a wide problem today, I would say the majority of Americans are actually suffering with this chronic low-level inflammation.
We've understood for some time now that obesity can put people at risk for a whole lot of health problems. What does obesity have to do with chronic inflammation?
Well, the fat around your visceral organs, and these are your internal organs, your internal abdominal organs, that type of fat is actually very active. It's not fat that just kind of stays in your body. It does a variety of things. And one of the most important things it does is to act like an immune organ. So that type of fat is comprised of immune cells. In the markedly obese, almost half of the cells in their fat are actually immune cells. And those immune cells churn out inflammatory markers at all hours of the day. And obesity and the inflammation tied to obesity is thought to be associated with a variety of disorders that folks who have excess fat are prone to developing.
Is that one reason that some studies during COVID-19 found that people with obesity tended to be at greater risk of severe disease than people without obesity?
That is one thing that could be playing a part, certainly. And you have other things going on in obesity as well. You know, the mechanics of how you take in air and just the structural component of having excess fat. But one of the things in pandemics and epidemics and viral illnesses like COVID-19 is that if you have this silent, low-level inflammation running through your body, you know, particularly also with obesity and aging and such, you do have a greater risk of mounting an excessive inflammatory response to germs. A lot of times when we are faced with germs, it's not necessarily even the germ that causes immediate destruction of all of our organs, but it's rather our immune system's response to the germ that causes destruction all around our bodies. And when you have that silent inflammation, it makes it harder for your body to fight the germ. It's kind of like excessive noise that is happening in the body that makes it harder for the body to actually target what it needs to. And at the same time, the body is more prone to mounting massive inflammation that can cause severe damage.
Why might inflammation play a contributing role in the development of a disease like type 2 diabetes?
Well, inflammation and diabetes are tied together. There are many associations between inflammation and type 2 diabetes. And, you know, when you look at the metabolic syndrome in general, folks who are obese are, if you have obesity, high blood pressure, high blood sugars, you're more prone to actually developing heart disease and diabetes. So all of these disorders are connected, and they tell us that we have these biological vulnerabilities and common risk factors, and inflammation is one of those common risk factors. It's not the only potential cause, of course, of these disorders, but it is a central and important potential cause.
As a physician, Shilpa, I know you're aware. I mean, I'm sure ideally you would like your patients not to be dealing with obesity when they have other health problems. It's not quite as simple as telling people to go home and lose weight and fix themselves. What have you learned as a doctor about helping people regain some of that health, even if they really struggle to take off the excess weight?
I think it's certainly tough, and I think one of the things that I think is very important is to have a support system, have folks that are there that are able to help you in this new journey as well, and to start with small steps, because I think even going from, for example, the certain diet from the Western diet to 100% whole foods plant-based, or a 90 or 80% whole foods plant-based diet, that is a huge change for your body, and it's not going to happen overnight. And in fact, having a cohort of bacteria in your gut, having the appropriate cohort of bacteria to manage all of that fiber is important, and that cohort gets built up over time. So if you go from 0 to 100 overnight, then you are likely to have a variety of symptoms in your body that may discourage you. But it's really about taking those very small steps every day and incrementally sort of increasing the amount of whole plant foods in your diet or with any other lifestyle change. You don't necessarily need to sign up for a gym membership or exercise for 2 hours a day, but even those baby steps that you can make, all of it adds up. Even incorporating maybe a standing desk for a while at work, or taking the stairs instead of the elevator, all of these little things really do add up and change the physiology over time. So I think one of the most important things I stress is just starting small, having support, and then also just making this a pleasurable journey, finding things that you like to do, finding the foods that you like to eat, because the anti-inflammatory diet is really not an exclusive diet. It includes so many foods, so much more than what it excludes. And so it's about finding the path that you really enjoy taking and slowly incorporating that into your life.
You've mentioned plants here several times. Why are plants better as anti-inflammatory things to eat than animal foods?
Well, one of the most important things that we find is that whole plant foods are the best food for the gut microbiome, and the gut microbiome plays an essential part in health and in inflammation. So when we eat all of those processed foods or the standard Western diet, which is filled with excess sugar, excess salt, excess animal fat, we are starving the gut microbiome. And so this means that the majority of our diet really does need to be comprised of whole plant foods. And these plants, in addition to the fiber, they have so many vitamins and minerals that are important for the immune system, and also polyphenols, which are phytochemicals. And we haven't established a deficiency state for polyphenols, but when you walk into the grocery store and you see all of those colorful fruits and vegetables, and they are filled with polyphenols, which are actually chemicals that plants have made to protect themselves against danger. And some polyphenols, can be immensely protective for humans as well, and help to manage inflammation in the body.
This might really surprise people. Tell us about this growing body of evidence that inflammation may play a role in mental illness.
It's actually a very interesting concept, because for so long, traditionally, we were thought to have either diseases of the body or diseases of the mind, and they were thought to be very separate, disparate things. And now we are learning so much more about the connection, for example, between the brain, the gut, and the microbiome. We are learning about how, for example, the gut has so much of the immune system, and it has a lot of the nervous system as well. And so the diseases of the body and the diseases of the mind are actually more connected than we think. And when you have inflammation that's happening in the body, whether it's in the gut and kind of floating around the body, we know that that inflammation can make its way to the brain as well. We used to think that the blood-brain barrier, which separated the blood and the brain, the rest of the body, the brain, was a very rigid type of thing. But we actually know now that immune cells and inflammatory molecules can actually cross that blood-brain barrier. So the inflammation that you have in your body can make its way to the brain, where it affects nerve cells, for example, where it affects your learning, your cognition, your mood. And that's been a very fascinating area of research, and it's uncharted territory at large still, but it's something that scientists are learning more and more about every day.
What are they finding out about the potential links between chronic inflammation and the dementia brought on by Alzheimer's disease?
Well, we know that Alzheimer's disease, genetics have a big part in Alzheimer's disease, but we know that also a lifestyle does as well. So there are certain risk factors like obesity and diabetes. About a third of the cases of Alzheimer's disease are also tied to facts other than genetics. And scientists have found, for example, in autopsy studies, that there are patients who build up these plaques that we see, these misfolded plaques in Alzheimer's called amyloid and tau, these tangles. And they build up those proteins, but they actually never get the disease in their lifetime. So they're seeing that there's a population of patients in whom this happens. And what they're finding is that the folks who actually do have the actual clinical disease in their lifetime, those folks are the ones who are more likely to have immune cells and inflammation in the brain.
Shilpa, if I have this right, we've long understood that inflammation is a consequence of lots of different kinds of diseases. It sounds like now we recognize it may actually be a driving force, a thing that makes us get sick.
Yes, exactly. We've been talking about inflammation for a very long time, and even in medical schools, folks teach inflammation, and we see it in every disease, really, almost every disease. It's omnipresent. It's often known to be a consequence of disease, and there are so many syndromes that are named according to how inflamed the body is. Nephritis, inflammation of the kidneys. Meningitis, inflammation of the brain. And so what we're actually finding now is that inflammation can also be a cause of disease. It can in itself be a driver. And the data for causation is stronger in some disorders like cardiac disease than others. But we are finding that inflammation can actually cause or is tied to our most modern pressing killers: heart disease, cancer, obesity, diabetes, neurodegenerative disease. And this is somewhat of a paradigm shift because now we know that one, inflammation is a cause, and two, we do have some of the tools that we can use to change our lifestyles in order to calm inflammation, to prevent it from doing its damage down the line.
There are some drugs out there that are used temporarily to reduce inflammation. I'm thinking about steroids and the class of drugs known as NSAIDs, like Advil and that kind of thing. What are the pros and cons of these medications, and can they really be used to target the kinds of inflammation we've been talking about today?
Well, one of the problems with steroids and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents, and a lot of the drugs that we have today as well, is that they are not very specific in treating inflammation. And that's one of the challenges in dealing with inflammation, chronic inflammation of any kind, because it is such a heterogeneous force. And trying to treat that kind of a force, which pathways do we manipulate? And we've evolved so many redundancies in the system that when we sort of address one pathway, another might take over. And we use non-steroidals like ibuprofen and aspirin, all of these drugs pretty commonly, and they can do some good things for the body. They can help our pain. They can actually give us some comfort. Aspirin is also used in prevention certain disorders, recurrent heart attacks, some cancers. And so there are certain cases in which they can be useful, but we also tend to overuse them for not great reasons at times. And the problem there becomes that these drugs do have side effects, including gastrointestinal bleeding. You can develop peptic ulcers and have even life-threatening bleeding from excessive use of some of these non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. And steroids as well have a variety of side effects in the body. They dramatically suppress the immune system. And whenever you dramatically suppress the immune system, you are prone to developing more infections and perhaps higher risk of cancer and a variety of other problems. And we do have more specific anti-inflammatory drugs now that we use in rheumatology and also as gastroenterologists and even in transplant medicine. But the drugs do come with certain side effects, and so it's important to take into consideration the risk-benefit ratio of how much help are we doing versus how much harm are we doing.
So, to maintain lifelong health without too much inflammation, it sounds like there will not be some pill that we can just pop and not think about lifestyle factors.
I would say not anytime soon. That would be my guess for sure. I think, we have amazing drugs for certain conditions today. Some of the drugs we use in transplant medicine are quite necessary in order to keep our bodies from rejecting organs and such. But when it comes to, preventative medicine, when it comes to saying, let's deal with the silent chronic inflammation that you may not even know that you have, it really does come down to addressing the lifestyle factors, the root causes of this type of inflammation. And this type of inflammation is so insidious that it may just be in your body for a very long time, and the price of this inflammation may not be evident till years or even decades later. So it's not something that may occur all of a sudden, but down the line. And it's really something that is a lifestyle change.
How does an excess of salt contribute to inflammation?
Salt is necessary for the human body, and we need a certain amount of salt. And it's not really the salt that we use in our daily cooking that's the problem, but the excess salt that we find in processed goods, canned goods, packaged goods. When we go out to a restaurant, for example, we can eat enough salt in a meal that meets a day's worth of our daily recommended amounts of salt in just one meal. So it's really all of that excessive salt that's the primary problem. And when you have that excessive salt in your body, then that actually is quite inflammatory on many different levels. It can activate inflammatory molecules and cells. It can drive immune cells to behave differently in the body. And it's something to be mindful of because it's just so omnipresent. We find that it's very easy to consume high levels of salt without even knowing it. So we really need to be looking at the labels on the back of these packaged and processed goods. And at home, it's totally fine to use some salt, depending on your health condition, of course, because in some health conditions like liver disease and high blood pressure, you may want to go down on the salt. But generally, fine to use salt at home in your cooking, and also salt substitutes are a great idea to help go down on the salt intake.
What about sugar? If in small, infrequent doses, it's not toxic in the way that we normally think of toxic substances, why does too much sugar too often have the potential to mess up our guts and harm us?
I think that's a great point. It's what you just said is that it's not toxic in small doses. And when you look at the Mediterranean diet in rural Naples in the 1950s, and you see that they are eating a variety of whole plant foods 90% of the time, and they would have desserts on special occasions. And so it's not sugar in and of itself that is a toxic substance. It's more, again, as with salt, the excess of sugar. And we know today that sugar, a high amount of sugar intake is tied to a variety of chronic inflammatory disorders like heart disease, cancer, obesity, diabetes. So it does far more than just rot your teeth. And in fact, obviously, what's happening in your mouth is also a problem because, if you develop things like gingivitis and gum disease, that's inflammation in your mouth that could be spilling over to the rest of your body and creating a higher risk of some of these other chronic inflammatory disorders. And so sugar also, just like salt, can weave its way into our lives pretty easily. If you have that morning pastry with your coffee and maybe a can of Coke at lunch and a dessert at dinner, some ice cream, that in and of itself, if you have that routinely every day, that's enough to increase the visceral fat in your body, that silent hidden fat that churns out inflammation, and to increase your risk of chronic inflammatory disorders.
Why are fermented foods thought to be especially good for us?
Well, fermentation is an ancient technique. Cultures have been practicing this technique for a very, very long time when we didn't have refrigerators. And what it involves is cultivating beneficial bacteria within and atop foods. So fermentation can intrinsically change the architecture of a food, and in good ways, in many, many good ways. It can break down, some of the sugars, so there's less sugar in food. It can improve the vitamin and mineral content. It can break down some of the so-called anti-nutrients in foods, and it can inculcate these foods with beneficial bacteria. So when you're eating fermented foods, like say fermented vegetables, for example, then these foods are coming into your body and they have bacteria beneficial bacteria that are coming into your body along with them. And even if these bacteria don't stick around in the gut, colonize the gut, they are still having conversations with the other bacteria in your gut, and they are still doing beneficial things inside of your body, even if they may or may not colonize. And even if the food is cooked, you know, sometimes you have fermented foods that are cooked, like a hearty sourdough bread, you still find that, you know, you can have dead bacteria, bacterial metabolites that change, you know, the intrinsic changes in the food. So all of those things are beneficial for the body. So fermentation in as a whole is a very wonderful practice that we can use in our daily lives and how we prepare food and how we consume food.
One thing people may want to keep in mind, Shilpa, is that fermented foods, lots of people go straight to pickles. The shelf-stable jar of pickles that might have been sitting on the grocery store shelves for a month and then 6 months after that in our fridge, that is not necessarily fermented in the classic way, right? That's preserved with salt and vinegar.
Exactly. So those are not the traditional fermented foods, because those foods, you know, can for one have a very, very high salt content, and that in and of itself would probably make you want to stay away from them. But some of those foods are actually not the traditional fermented foods. And it's quite easy if you're at home to look up a few recipes and ferment foods at home, or you may be able to obtain small batch fermented foods at farmers markets. But every batch of fermented foods turns out a bit differently, and it doesn't take too much in terms of a chef's knowledge in order to be able to ferment foods at home as well. So it's a lot of fun to sort of experiment with some of these different foods, and it's what ancient cultures all around the world really have been doing for a very, very long time.
What is an elemental diet?
An elemental diet is kind of what it sounds like. It's a diet that's broken up into its elemental components, so proteins, carbohydrates, fats. And this is the type of diet that we use sometimes in patients, say, with inflammatory bowel disease when they come into the hospital, particularly in kids, and they have severe intestinal inflammation, and we sort of just want to calm that inflammation down. So it's a diet that's devoid of food antigens and such, and this type of diet can actually calm inflammation as well as steroids can.
I don't want to end this conversation without having a good talk about the importance of moving our bodies. Exercise initially causes a little bit of inflammation, right? Why would it be helpful for reducing hidden inflammation in the long term if we're doing it vigorously and regularly?
You're right, absolutely right. Exercise can cause inflammation initially. And again, it comes down to this balance of inflammation when you're exercising. So when you exercise, and even when you're strength training, for example, you develop these micro tears in your muscle, and inflammation, you know, comes, and then it resolves, and then it regenerates. So you're able to build muscle that way. And you need a little bit of inflammation when you exercise. But routine, regular exercise, if you do this, it has been shown across age groups in dozens of clinical trials to calm down low-level inflammation. And so exercise is just immensely helpful in so many different ways. One obvious example is that it does melt the inflammatory fat. So it melts the belly fat, it decreases the fat. But even in the absence of weight loss, exercise can still calm inflammation throughout the body.
There are millions of recommendations if we go online looking for how much exercise we need every day, what type. What do you tell patients who are looking to get started and taking better care of their bodies this way?
I actually do something similar as what I recommend with food, because I think it's important to start small and to start with something that's pleasurable. And starting small is also important from an inflammatory standpoint, because exercising in the wrong way can actually be inflammatory. If you are not used to exercising at all, and then all of a sudden one day you go to the gym and work out for 3 hours, that's not so good for your body. So you want to start small. You want to incorporate exercise into your daily movements. That means that if you're driving to work, you know, is it possible at all to walk or take the bike? You know, is it possible to take the stairs at work? And beyond that, walking, brisk walking, is actually a great form of exercise. You know, it doesn't have to be, the exercise that you do does not have to be done for hours every day in a fancy gym. And simply by doing that type of exercise, you can actually decrease inflammation.
Dr. Shilpa Ravella is a transplant gastroenterologist with expertise in nutrition, also an assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University Medical Center. Her new book is called A Silent Fire, the story of inflammation, diet, and disease. Shilpa, this has been really interesting. I so appreciate the time you've spent with us. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram just by searching for KERA Think. You can subscribe to our podcast free where you get your podcasts. You can also find the podcast at our website where you can sign up for our e-newsletter and see what kinds of shows we have planned in the future. That website is think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.